Part 1. Peter Bisegger is still living in Switzerland, in a house in the middle of nowhere. It's very idyllic. I guess for him the biggest challenge for the reconstruction was to get the right size and the right dimensions. He had to get a reconstruction from just 3 photographs, and he had to consider the technical things and the architectural things before anything else. Those considerations were really in the foreground of his reconstruction of Metzbar. In addition to this, any consideration for the context, the history, and the development of Merzbau came from Ernst Schwitters, Kurt's son. And this is not documented. We don't know what Ernst told Peter, and all we have are some anecdotes from Peter. For example, Peter Bisegger says that Ernst tried to jump from a step and tried to remember how high the step and jump was in the Merzbau. But this was from when he was a child of 12 or 14 years old. So these kind of personal memories have helped rebuild it. But you really can't be sure if the step was really this size or not. We know a lot of anecdotes like this from Peter.
Hello, I'm Callie Spooner, and I'm here with the artists Jesse Ash and Ben Kane in a programme that we're calling The Movable Column. Kurt Schwitters is generally acknowledged as the 20th century's greatest master of collage, but for 13 years, and 1923 to 1936, he also worked on an extraordinary construction that came to be known as the Merzbau, which spread to 8 rooms of his house in Hanover and eventually spread to 2 other sites as well, a hut in Norway and a barn in England. Kurt Schwitters described the Merzbau as his life's work. The Merzbau in Hanover was a fantastically constructed interior. The walls and ceiling were covered with a diversity of 3-dimensional shapes, and the room itself was crowded with materials and objects, some totally obstructed by later additions to the work. The Merzbau was, on principle, an uncompleted work and continued to grow, changing constantly until it was destroyed in Allied bombings and then reconstructed by the Swiss theatre designer Peter Bisegger and the curator Harold Zeman from the only remaining 3 black and white photos. The Movable Column has derived from thinking about artists who are engaged in questions of reconstruction, finitude and work in progress, and who we've been speaking to about Merzbau.
No end to objects. Why not? We thought objects were over. This is what we hear from more than 150 years ago, and now again. At that point, we moved from a world of images to a world of writing, altogether more democratic. Anthropologists deplore the supposed tyranny of vision based on the optical appropriation of thing-like data, and choose to tap instead into an invisible realm by studying narrative. All the things we've made so far continue to echo, and that echo permeates, resounds and reforms as a thing or as things, many of them. The incessant sound of objects in the making is our discreet daily company. How to intervene in this sound, that's a question. To insert a tap or a click, a roll, just an uncontrollable release of breath. That's the equivalent of raising a voice above the noise of rather less mobile tools and machines. Or it's the reincarnation of the voice as a machine, or it's the absorbing of the voice into the unresponsive linear pattern of a machine. This happens all the time. Listening is intervening. Intervening is to alter a flow or redirect a line. Altering a flow is to reshuffle the component parts, and listening means stepping away and stepping closer at the same time. All of which finally means that the thing, the final output, might be a solid sphere of black plastic rather than a solid sphere of oak or a cooling sphere of recently molten glass. That changes things a lot. A factory as a radio and vice versa, and listening as a tool. Yesterday a man said to an artist, as a form of encouragement to production, I, work, work, work. I might have been better translated as look or even see. Either way, it's a worrying mantra, but more digestible if you stick only to the first half of the directive. Look, 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 I. Continually processing the physical world, ear. If we're sick of the word output, apparently there's armies of people for whom the word outcome is synonymous with pain or anger, then we can be happy to intervene without end. Wedge words in every widening gap. This will lead to objects without end, or a thing, a cast-off, or a byproduct, which will itself be a sign of interaction, a thing which can't help but reveal its own history of infinite points of intervention. So you, our beautiful instrument, enter the story and wrestle significance away from the object for all to see, and instead draw all objects into the orbit of the evolving self, you again. Towards something, most likely a ruin, a space that's a ruin, a pile of material and the remnants of recent action. No, ruin is wrong. Workshop is better, but again with the close proximity of, and guides for, action, which one falls into, sinks into the swing of it, in part through physical empathy, nodding or turning when someone nods or turns, and in part through an unexplainable desire to work. A large open workspace, with lengths of timber laid out on the floor. The 2x1 smooth cut timber is painted with trompe l'oeil black and gold marble effect. The pieces are arranged on the floor in a way that suggests a complex of walkways and closed spaces. However hard we try, we still can't use sound as a substitute for space. How do we look at something when it's constantly moving, in a situation where there are no more still objects, but rather only 24/7 making? So we watch making, and watching making becomes making itself, and listening to making also becomes making. The production machine is then all-consuming, and here desperation and production go hand in hand. A short while ago this seemed ideal, that making and doing would be all-pervasive, and that these nouns, very close to verbs, should be tangible in all things. Now the omnipresence of action seems oppressive, neurosis-inducing, and I'd rather replace it with rest. It's late now. In this reconfigured form, sometime down the line, all the sounds become a ruin. All the parts that interconnected the words and sounds vanish, and consequently the whole structure collapses. It's leveled to the ground just before it's begun, every time starting over with raw material and no indication of what stood here before. We call this dauntingly open space a workshop. This sound longs for things, and misses at least one image. The image will be that of the instrument which is used here, which is a solid block of gleaming bronze, an ingot, in its raw, ready-to-melt-and-pour state.
a lovely voice you have, Ben.
I was just thinking the opposite.
No way. Thanks. It's lovely. It's very hypnotic. Is it an endless work?
Yeah, what it was planned, first of all, is an endless work. I think here, it's sort of the first stage of something. I think this is... I think there's going to be lots of other stages. And I think one of the things, actually, that slightly bothers me about it is the voice. I'm really not sure about the voice, but that's always the way, isn't it? Whenever you speak something yourself, it's something which is sort of immediately... It's a problem, you know? You're thinking, oh, God, no, I can't stand it. But there's that. But I think there's also, I don't know, there are qualities in the voice and the way that I speak it that I think are not right and that needs to be looked at again. But, besides that, I think lots of the things that I'm making really have no particular end. You know, they have sort of stopping off points along the way, and this is probably one of those. But it was also, it's also made to be, the initial sort of plan was that it would be made as a series of sort of separate parts. It talks about component parts in it, but a series of separate parts that I would somehow be able to sort of feed into a software that would then be able to endlessly remix these component parts. That's the idea, but I haven't got to that stage yet, and it's sort of tricky to, you know, it's tricky to figure out how to actually make that work and to find somebody who's, you know, who can manage that sort of software. It's not as, you know, you think these things and you think, well, you know, it should be like this, but you know,
there's a few boys upstairs, isn't there?
Or maybe, maybe.
You're talking about this continual sort of process.
Yeah.
And it's sort of going on and on and on. And I mean, there's a really nice sort of... There's a ritualistic, almost spiritual thing going on in the background. I almost feel like someone's sort of leading me to believe something somewhere. That's another thing maybe. But okay. I'm thinking these continuous things. I remember speaking to someone about the steel hammer in Sheffield. In fact, my partner was saying that she only recognised the steel hammer in Sheffield when she left Sheffield.
What's a steel hammer?
It's the big hammer in the factory that...
Literally, the steel hammer.
Yeah, yeah.
But she only recognised the sound when it was gone.
When she left and then came back to it. Mm. And I was just sort of thinking about moving, being with sound. Hearing it, like, I suppose if anyone's listening now, you know, you're here now listening. And then what it is to walk out and make a cup of tea and think of what the sound is next door. And what it is to have that distance, because you're talking about being away from something, and then
there's lots of things that are about drifting away from the object and drifting away from the subject. I think lots of the things in this text are all about moving away from it, and moving away from it in order to be able to get closer to it in some way, sort of distancing yourself from it in order to be able to get a better sort of sense of what it is. There was them, you know, in the notes that you gave, actually, there's some sort of talk about the idea of seeing something and then being away from it for a certain amount of time in order to let an image, or to let the sort of presence of that thing settle, and then to be able to sort of come back to it in another space, you know, a space which is elsewhere, and at that point you encounter in some way what it is that you've seen or what it is that you've experienced physically.
I mean if we try and hold it back a little bit as well to Merseburg, you've got this big architectural space which has been constructed over a period of time. It gets blown up, disappears. And then it's reconstruction based on these three photographs. It's very specific to a time away from that making, like decades later. It's like but in a way it's removal from its making or its process of making.
But I also think what's rather interesting about kind of Merseburg is that although kind of Kurt Schwitters had to leave it behind because the kind of the Gestapo were after him at the time, and he had to kind of leave Hanover and leave Germany at the time, and then moved himself to kind of Norway, was that although he'd kind of left the Merseybau, this kind of huge construction that he was working on every day that was part of his daily life, he had to kind of leave that behind. He just sort of picked up where he left off in Norway, which I kind of quite like, which is sort of the ultimate distance, I suppose, from something before you sort of pick up and start again. But I mean, what I find kind of interesting is the idea of stopping something but leaving open the possibility that you can start it again later, and that it can perhaps be different slightly.
But is stopping was sort of pronounced by the photographs as well, weren't they? Which we're going to lead on to a bit in a bit more, but it was, they're sort of stimulated by working from particular photographs, and that's when it stopped in his mind. There's this sort of, there's a continual process of Merseybau, but then he's sort of saying at one point, I see this as a finitude or a point of finitude, and that's based on these photographs.
Well, it's probably just worth kind of contextualizing what the photos are then. I mean, so you've got Merseybau, which is this kind of enormous evolving construction, essentially a kind of a 3D collage that Kurt Schwitters was working on every day. And it kind of finally got to the point where he invited sort of photographers really into the space to document the work at a specific kind of point. And although it was sort of evolving in a number of different rooms and spreading throughout his home, there was one particular room which he in a way felt he was ready to have photographed, I suppose, but that didn't in any way represent the Merseybau in its entirety. But then when it came to the Merseybau having to be documented later because it had kind of been blown up in the Allied bombings, it was from these three photographs of this one particular room, of this one particular construction at a particular point in time, that the entire rebuild of Merseybau arrived from. And I suppose that seems like a shame in some way.
But it is, I think, I suppose what's nice in relation to Ben's thing is you've got this, supposedly this ongoing process that he goes on making until the end of his life, and is part of who he is and what he does and routine, la la la. But there are this punctuation point where he makes something which stops, and he makes something that stops based on three photographs that he authored or had a lot of control on. And when in listening to Ben's piece, you've got this sort of sense of a continual process, or this maybe ritualistic whispering in the back of your ear, but at the same time you're talking about material, you're talking about very specific clanking and clangings of like the solidity of things, you know. And so I suppose I'm trying to make this sort of reference point between a material and its stability, as it as you know, you could argue that with the photograph there are these points of stability in relation to an ongoing process. And I don't know, I was just thinking of gold.
Why were you thinking of gold?
I was thinking of gold because of the economy and how the value is based on its stability.
You having a bit of a riff?
Yeah, it's going
on. You're going on a bit of a riff, Jesse.
It sounded a bit like that, isn't it? It is. You talked about molten glass.
Yeah, molten. Yeah, I did, actually. Yeah, and plastic and oak and a few other sort of bits of material. But they're all, you know, it mentions material all the time in order to, it's something about this sort of instability of the word oak or glass or wood or heavy things like bronze. So it's this, you know, on one hand it's entirely sort of unstable because it's a word, it's a sound, so it drifts, it's unstable, and meaning is unstable in words that are spoken, you know. And then there is, at the same time, there is something which is totally sort of solid, it's physical, and you're able apparently to envisage this thing, you know. It can be, you somehow sort of picture it. You're able even to, I think with the sounds, you know, when you have the sound of something like bronze and you have the sound of bronze being hit, as you do in this, and, you know, scraped and so on and so on, it's incredibly tangible. You know, it's something which is it's very palpable. It's a sort of an internal type of physical, what's the word? I don't know. You're sort of able to sort of touch it in some way through this sound. It's internalized sort of physical character. And so there are these two things sort of side by side that I'm really intrigued by, you know. There's something which is entirely sort of concrete and something which is really, it's totally sort of uncertain and unstable.
Fluid,
yeah.
mobility from stasis or something like that, which is kind of true. Yeah. I'm wondering whether we should move on to another track and then come back to talking about it. So, I'll play it now.
We also know from Ernst's own writings and text that he believed he was the most informed person on the Mertzvah Hanover. There was a level of identification from Ernst, which is problematic. He felt he was the only person who could decide what the right interpretation of the reconstruction really was. He could hear the voice of his father on this, but no one else could know this voice like him. And it's a little problematic because these are his own personal memories from being a child. And then, 50 years after he last saw the Mertzbau, he tries to remember how high the step is. It's very problematic to make replicas or reproductions from such memories.
So, I'm wondering how that relates to Ben.
can I jump in with that Herodotus thing?
He's got a little Herodotus quote.
Anyone who knows Callie's work knows that she's up for informal speech and tangents, and this man certainly was. And so Herodotus, the father of history, who got completely condemned for not having a truly historical approach, and my friend, who's an out and out historian, always takes a piss out of me for being a postmodernist sort of arty knob, and he holds the truth, which I think is ridiculous. Anyway, so Herodotus is talking about how he went about his history of the Peloponnesian War, and he talks. Now, I'm not in a position to say with absolute certainty that Xerxes did send this message to Argos, and that a delegation did arrive and did go to Susa to ask Artaxerxes about their friendship. But I am obliged to record the things I am told. But I'm certainly not required to believe them. This remark may be taken to apply to the whole of my account. And so why I wanted to jump in there was this whole thing about Mertzbau's reconstruction being based on the idea of Ernst.
Who was his son, who was Kirchritter's son, and the whole construction, not the whole construction, but the reconstruction of Mertzbau was based on a combination of these three black and white fixed photographs, and also the kind of the fallible memory of Ernst Ritters, who was about sort of 12, 14, and maybe 8 when Mertzbau was being built, and maybe 18 the last time he saw it. And so Peter Beisiger, kind of working with the sort of the Swiss theatre designer trying to rebuild this Mertzbau construction, was working from three photos, and also working alongside Ernst's kind of memory of what he sort of thought it might look like, and sort of evidence shows that Ernst's memory was sort of perpetually wrong. And
she had a real problem with him, didn't she? She was very sort of specific about the importance of getting the right story, and obviously, you know, Ernst was sort of getting in the way of that.
Well, this is the... Jesse's talking about the...
I've got to tell you what I'm talking about, haven't I?
Jesse is talking about the curator of the Kirchritter's archive in Hanover, who we had a meeting with and spoke with about the kind of the pros and the cons of the installation, I suppose, and the general consensus was that Ernst's memory wasn't kind of particularly the best... the best memory, or the very best way of rebuilding something correctly. And then I suppose that relates to your kind of quote and the gripe you have with your historically responsible friend, because how?
Well, I suppose it's saying, okay, well, what's the role of the museum for starters? Which is, do we reconstruct it as best possible? Do we, like, you know, carve it out of, you know, the perfect. In fact, just before we went on air, you said, "What do I need something? Do I need any facts?"
I said, "No, I don't need any facts."
Yeah, exactly.
But I do, though. I mean, that was irresponsible.
That is irresponsible. But no, there's this idea that the thing about Merzbau was that it was, it happened then and there, and then it's always going to be a moment in time, and it's going to refer to the making of that time. And when it stops, as it did, it refers to whatever it was, 1933, and it refers to his moment, his time, and how he was thinking. And in a sense, I sort of, you know, although this curator was saying we need to get back to that, I sort of feel that all the sort of the voices in its reconstruction is in a way that a similar authorship as Kurt Schwitter's had with the Merzbau. It's an accumulation at that moment. So you've got Ernst, the son, and his memories of just jumping around and hitting his head on the door frame or whatever it is. You've got Biziker, who's thinking architecturally. You've got the curators who are trying to explain it to the public, and you've got the architecture of the institution, and they're all sort of combining in the same way as Kurt Schwitter's had to deal with. And so I was sort of a bit confused at her, well, not confused, maybe I just disagreed with her desire to have the original, because it didn't end up looking like what we thought it would. It was a bit of a mess, wasn't it?
Yeah, the reconstruction was a bit of a mess. Although, yeah, it looked a bit like a stage set, which I suppose is the nature of reconstructions, because they're always kind of props and they're never kind of entirely real. But I wanted to sort of think about it a bit more in relation to Ben's work, really. I don't know, really predominantly about this idea of reaching these moments of stabilization, I suppose, in an otherwise sort of moving process. And I suppose I wanted to ask you why. I mean, it's a very finished work that you've made, this kind of sound piece that you've shown us. But do you feel like it's one part of something that's otherwise going to be evolving or changing, or
it's you know, the first thing we talked about when we came on was just these three photographs and the idea of those photographs being the starting point for a reconstruction. And I think about this sound as being a series of sounds and words that are the starting point for reconstruction, you know, that they are, they're sort of the platform for something to be built from, you know. I'm thinking about this sound, the whole sound altogether, the voice and the words and la la la, as a workspace and a place of work, and a place from which things are made somehow. You know, that it's a starting point. That these actions give rise to some sort of sense of a mode of production, that certain sorts of words, when they start to intermingle together, give a sort of sense of the materials that might be used. You know, that's a series of sort of modular parts that I think, through the process of listening, ought to be animated somehow. So in that respect, I think about it as a sort of starting point for reconstruction. Okay. So it's finished on one hand, it's really just the sort of the first stage in something which should be moving towards the future, rather than it being about a series of sounds that record or document actions that have disappeared and are now part of the past. You know, it should be something which is more generative rather than something like a document.
Okay, nice. I'm going to play another track.
I guess it is totally okay to try to make a replica, but this kind of replica, here at the museum, is also historical. It's a state of information. It was built in the beginning of the 80s, and it has been influenced by information from Ernst, but you really do have to have a critical distance on such things. Generally, visitors to the Merzbau are given a text, so they can be aware that this is not the original. It is a historical reconstruction, and it can only give you an idea of the original. Of course, this is always the case if you show replicas in the museum. Visitors often don't realise what they have in front of them.
Okay, there's something I want to play, and I don't know whether it's going to be entirely appropriate after Ben's very beautiful work, but I'll give you a bit of context. I wanted to bring a Walter Benjamin quote on and talk about The Task of the Translator, which is a text about translation and about the importance of not necessarily redoing things as a like-for-like correspondence, but that a kind of an accurate or not an accurate, but a kind of a responsible translation might actually attempt to grapple with the intentions of the original thing and accept that the final outcome or product of that might be very different to how the original thing was. But I was having a meeting with a very interesting curator called Matthew Copeland, who makes very interesting kind of curatorial projects that tend to evolve in kind of parts and additions and acts and sort of pretty endless, really, as projects. And he told me that it would not... He told me, don't read a Walter Benjamin quote. That's far too cliched, and frankly, you're far too interested in other things, and there's surely other options and that you could possibly present. And so he has given me a track to play instead to try and cheer things up. So here we go.
The decision to make the reconstruction as it is may be...
Okay, sorry, I played Dulcie, who is reading our historically responsible text instead of that cover of a Duran Duran song, which Matthew gave me. But now we finally got to the cover of a Duran Duran song, and I think the reason why I wanted to play it is because that song isn't by Duran Duran, it's actually by the Lost Prophets. And I'm sorry, this is a really bad, slightly kind of hammy way of wanting to talk about what it means to redo something. But I was hoping we could talk about it anyway, in relation to the Walter Benjamin text, which I've decided not to read. Just simply thinking about this idea of, of kind of redos, I suppose.
So is a cover a cast? Is a Ben's pouring molten stuff and hammering out things up in Sheffield. Is a cast a cover?
Is a cast a cover?
Is a cover a cast?
Is a cast a mould?
Mould. Let's say mould, yeah. Yeah, mould.
Is a cast a cover? Is a mould a cover?
Yeah, well,
I don't know.
No, it's not. I mean, the thing is that it's kind of a completely different thing, isn't it? And I think the whole point of a kind of a cover or redoing something is that it can be something kind of completely different to the original, and perhaps sort of assessing it on the terms of the original isn't necessarily the right thing to do, which is kind of relates to Merzbau in the sense that maybe this reconstruction that we have available at the De Sprengel Museum in Hanover isn't necessarily supposed to kind of represent in its entirety the mutability and the changeability of the kind of the original Merzbau. Maybe we need to accept that it's a kind of a piece of history, a state of information, a kind of a stage, if you like, to be able to animate the story of Merzbau. But that, you know, trying to hope for this thing to have any of the original properties of the original changeable thing is a unfeasible thing to hope for, I suppose.
It's sort of flawed, isn't it, from the outset, really?
Yeah, it's flawed from the outset. You mean it's flawed from the outset to hope that it would be anything like the original, or cover versions in general are flawed from the outset, which I would agree with.
Just to hope that it could be anything like the original.
Yeah.
You know, that you just have to take on board that it's not going to be that, and it's going to be all sorts of other things besides, and that's what you have to be happy with, I suppose.
But the fact of the matter is that that version is not as good as Duran Duran's original. Like, that is the simple case. And maybe, you know, cover versions just shouldn't be made. Maybe they should be banned.
Or maybe you should just have cover versions. Because, I mean, what about if we couldn't find Duran Duran? So we only had the representative. I'm thinking of the ballad.
What about if I never heard that Duran Duran track? This might be the ultimate sort of version for me. And when I heard that the original Duran Duran track, I might be very disappointed.
Or it might blow your mind, and you might realise that you've been living a lie.
Do we have the original?
We do. I'll have to fumble about a little bit finding it. Please, no more Duran Duran.
What about? I'm thinking of the Ballad of Ira Hayes, which is almost like a folk song, which. I'm not sure its location. I've only been listening to it recently, but Johnny Cash did it, Bob Dylan did it, a few others did it, and in a way, its presence is through its cover.
So it's existing through a cover version. Its afterlife is in a cover version, kind of thing. It's quite nice. Okay, I'm going to play another track.
The decision to make the reconstruction as it is maybe came from Peter, but ultimately the idea to reconstruct came from discussions with the curator, Harold Zeman, who initiated all this. It was his idea to make a replica, and we can assume he was also involved in the decisions relating to how it should be rebuilt. They had to use these three photographs to understand how deep the construction was and what was included in there. You just couldn't remake the Metzbau exactly as it was, but you could make a sign. You could make a detailed reproduction from these photographs. The photos are very professional, and if you enlarge them and try to make them a little lighter and darker in places, you can recognize a lot of details which you can't see in the reconstruction we have. So although these details were available to Harold and Peter, they're not really used, which makes this reconstruction a kind of representation for the reality. But who exactly decided it should be this way, we don't know. If we look at the enlargement of these photos, we can know a lot of other details, of course, but we can also know a lot of details from other sources and from other Metzbaus. There is one in Norway and one in the UK. And we also know from these that the Metzbau in Hanover would have included lots of material from all aspects of Schwitter's life. This we know to be true, because in the first year of Metzbau's development, he used Metzbau as his studio. He put up collage papers, wrapping papers, newspapers, all these materials that you can find in his collage works. So you can also assume that these materials would have appeared in the Metzbau itself.
You can assume that they might have appeared in the Metzbau itself, but not in there's no indication of it in the reconstruction, was there? When we were there, you're looking for this sort of layering of newspapers or something on the wall, that sort of crappy material.
Well, the collage effect.
And even if they're, you know, she says it's whitewashed because he was moving to his constructivist phase, as she says, but there was no indication of those layerings, those collagic, or whatever you might say, like layers.
Well, I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, kind of the Metzbau, because it was a part of Schwitter's life for so long. He was kind of personally and stylistically going through a number of different phases, I suppose, in his artistic career. So he kind of started off with his Dadaist period, if you like, in a very kind of literary period, and eventually moved into a period which was much more constructivist, I suppose. And it was when he hit, which is really radically different to a Dadaist kind of period, I suppose, and it was when he'd hit that constructivist period that the photos were taken and the reconstruction was built. So it sort of kind of missed out, you know, all the work that we recognise as being Schwitter's work, this kind of mad mash of bits of bus tickets, everyday life, newspapers, wallpapers, clippings, you know, the kind of the MERS principle of everything belonging to everything else was gone, really, by the time those photos were taken. It had been turned into a constructivist work. And so one of the things that I suppose we found most surprising when we went into the reconstruction was how little like a kind of a MERS collage, I suppose, it looked like, and just how kind of constructivist it had gotten. I suppose one of the things that raises, and it sort of relates to that sort of track and the sense that he was using it as his studio is maybe he was actually just going through a really long gestation period. You know, maybe it was just taking him a really long time to make a constructivist work. And he had to go through these kind of periods of kind of collaging and layering and then eventually kind of painting over that before he was sort of happy with it. I mean, maybe this romantic ideology we've got that Merzbau is this fantastic, mutable, evolving object and that needs to be kind of caught and captured in the reconstruction somehow isn't true. Maybe that was just studio time, you know, and it was studio time building up to a constructivist work, I suppose. But does that relate to a quote you want to read, Jesse?
Oh, it very well might do. Wonderful. That is seamless. I suppose you're talking, you see, I can't help thinking about about these stop points. You keep talking about we keep talking about these continual points and, you know, things like that. But to me, this is the big surprise was it stopped.
What, as a constructivist piece?
And it had to stop for it to be seen. No, not as a constructivist piece, as an ongoing process. The photograph stopped it, and he stopped it by externalising. He publicised the whole thing. All Merzbau is all about this intimate, very private obsession, which had to be private for both political...
Well, that's studio time, isn't it?
It's studio time, but it stopped, and then it became public. And there's this really important thing about making it public, and he made it public by making the photographs, and then it went to, I think, a French magazine, then it went to MoMA, the photographs. Mm-hmm. So he decided it needs to go outside, or it needs to leave him to be seen. Something that sort of relates to Ben's thing as well, which is about the rhythm of making, and made me, well, I've got loads of bits of paper around here, but before we came in, it made me think of this Henri Lefebvre. So I read all the sort of slightly knobby academic things, and you read the sort of
pop songs.
You do the pop songs. Yeah. Is that how this is? Right, great. Anyway, so this is Henri Lefebvre, and he's talking about, this is in Rhythm Analysis 2004. In order to grasp and analyse rhythms, it is necessary to get outside them, but not completely, be it through illness or a technique. A certain exteriority enables the analytic intellect to function. However, to grasp a rhythm, it is necessary to have been grasped by it. One must let oneself go, give oneself over, or abandon oneself to its duration, like in music and the learning of a language, in which one only really understands the meanings and connections when one comes to produce them, which is to say, to produce spoken rhythms. And just as I'm reading that, I'm thinking of your thing, Ben, because you say I, work, yeah, work, yeah. Work. But yeah. when I'm reading it, listeners won't have read I as E-Y-E.
No, probably not. Or maybe. You know, there's a possibility in that. I mean, it could be either way.
So I didn't know this. So in your sound work, where you say I, that's not the sort of the Beckett I that speaks.
Yeah, I mean, it might be that one, but it's also the EYE, and then it's followed by look, 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 and then there's also ear, ear, ear. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are sort of, it's pushed towards some particular, you know, it's pushed towards body part probably more than the body thing as one.
The overall.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is. But, yeah, I like this quote a lot. I think that the idea that you sort of, something in the sound that I made, which is about sort of empathetically, you know, through... In the text, it talks about watching somebody nod. And, you know, when you... It's a little bit like yawning or something, I suppose. When, you know, you watch somebody yawn and then you can't help but yawn. There's something about sort of following somebody's sort of physical actions. And through doing that, there's a process of understanding, you know. It's this sort of doing in order to know, you know. It's that.
I've actually done that once. If you have a conversation with someone and you can move your hands.
Yeah.
And they actually do... The same movement sometimes.
It's not
like a control thing. I'm not interested in that. But
you spend loads of time talking to people and trying to get them
Next time
I see you focusing really intently on me and doing weird things with your hands, you're trying to get me to.
It's crucial not to do it intently, Kelly.
So going back to the this idea of this eye and this sort of this.
Yeah.
This. I mean, I just wanted to. I don't know. I just wanted to talk a little bit more because that kind of relates to the fact that it's a piece of writing and you're playing with words and you're sort of doing all of these sort of other things with it that are fundamentally to do with writing. And for me, the kind of the piece was really interesting because you were starting to engage, I suppose, with the idea of the mutability of something or the kind of the changeability of something by describing it or through a piece of writing. And again, it goes back to the fact that this actual kind of piece of writing and the actual recording itself was very fixed. And so you had this very fixed frame, and then within it, you were sort of playing with the potential possibility of mutability and change, when in actuality that wasn't what the piece was at that particular moment in time.
Yeah, it's, you know, there it's all the way through it, I think, is this sort of combination of something which is totally fixed, something which is sort of understood and very clear on maybe on my part, and something which ought to move into a space which is much more fluid, as you said, you know, this where meaning becomes something which is collectively elaborated and something which is not grounded at all and something which is absolutely ongoing, you know, something which is sort of doesn't really stop. It just keeps on sort of mutating, and that's one it's can talk about that in relation to the eye, I suppose, as well. And it's, you know, like this sort of, you know, meaning or coming from a central position or a single author, and this one, or at least it wants to talk about, whether it does that or not, I don't know, but it wants to talk about trying to sort of give that over, I suppose.
I want to talk about it really quickly because we're running out of time, in relation to the idea of redoing your own work, or almost kind of doing, like redoing or revising your own pieces in a certain way. And that you're talking about this being a sort of a stable point, and then on top of that you're going to kind of rework it or redo it on top, and whether that turns into a kind of a cover version of your own work, if you like, in the nicest possible sense.
Well, I think it would, I think it would. It's like, the, you know, it is like a cast. And then, I think maybe a cast is a cover, by the way. I sort of thinking about it after a bit. Oh, I think it could be. But, I think it is, or it ought to be, as a sort of, you know, it's one of a whole, it's one version of many that will come, you know. And so in a way, it's, it is.
Okay, cool. Well, on that note, because we're running out of time, I'm going to just say thank you for listening to this programme, which is called The Movable Column, and it's part one. And we're going to be continuing with part two sometime in December, I believe, with another guest, and hopefully also with Ben in some shape or form, or the next permutation, perhaps, of his work, the kind of the cover version of his original, made by himself, which is weird. So try to tune in. But for now, thank you very much to Ben, and also for Matthew Copeland for suggesting I play a Duran Duran song, and also to Dulcie Jocelyn for having such a historically responsible sounding voice for the radio and reading the monologue of the Kirchritter's archive curator in Hanover so nicely. And I've just got one more track to play, and then we're done.
We also have some portrait photographs of Schwitters, which were taken in the 1920s. In these pictures, you can see Schwitters standing in front of a collage wall inside Metzbau. So Peter Bisegger didn't know about this picture, I guess. This portrait of Schwitters inside his Metzbau show the original state of the Metzbau development, before the state was reconstructed. So the walls were, in parts, full of collage. And it was only much later that Schwitters decided to paint it white, like the reconstruction shows. Within the white painting, there were additional colours, although the details of these we don't know. All we have is the memory of Ernst, who said the small details of colour were orange and grey. But this is really only memory, and it's doubtful as to how correct this is. We know, for instance, that the Metzbau in Norway was made in parallel to Metzbau Hanover, and there in Norway, you can still just about see traces of colours, and you can see that there is red, yellow, and blue, like the colours of Mondrian, but there is no orange or grey.